It.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the topic of today's class, well, the topic of the series as a whole is rereading Megillat Esther after October 7th. And the reason I titled it is that I really think that of all the books of Tanakh, Megillat Esther might be the one that has the most to say about our current predicament, our current time, last few months, since, namely, since October 7th, since the day that a number of Hamas terrorists massacred a lot of Jews, and the ensuing war that has taken place between in Israel and in Gaza. It's certainly been something that has been on a lot of people's minds, and I think that Megillat Esther responds to some of the questions in very
Life.
specific ways. I'm going to ask everyone if you can mute yourself, or maybe I'll mute everyone else myself. Okay, I'm going to mute everyone just so that feel free to unmute yourself if you have a question or to share it in the chat. Feel free to ask at some point. Okay, so in terms of the qu relevant questions, I want to preface by first saying that, to be clear, I'm not here to give like my own opinions on what's happening in Israel. Like, that's not the goal of this shir. What I mean to show is that there are clear parallels. I think Tanakh has something to say about it, but I'm not here to give a political speech or a particular view about what's happening in Israel. So don't ask me for one. And specifically, the first topic I want to talk about, perhaps the one that's been on a lot of people's minds, is this question of genocide. It's a word that has a lot of resonance, particularly for Jews, because of the fact that it's originated primarily post-Holocaust. But it's a word that has a lot of connotations. What I'm not going to do in this year is talk about the technical legal definition of the word genocide. That you can talk with lawyers and human rights activists and the like. That's not the point, what I want to talk about today. What I do want to talk about, though, is that the critique that has been leveled against Israel, that Israel is responsible for mass genocide, is one which, interestingly enough, is mirrored in the Book of Megillat Esther itself. Because Megillat Esther, while the story that in many ways mimics the story of what happened to the Jews in, to Israel on October 7th, there was a large group of people who hated us, who decimated us. So in Megillat Esther, it doesn't end up taking place. But as a result, there's almost this reprisal. And in Megillat Esther, the reprisal involves on the 13th of Adar, and then in Shushan, the 14th of Adar, the killing of many of the enemies of the Jews. And in many ways, the way that it could be read is that it seems a little bit disturbing sometimes if you read that particular scene. So let me share my screen and I'll just read through the story. And I kind of just want to show you first before we, kind of resolve the questions, kind of raise the questions that might arise that for some people might bother them when they read the Megillah. So let me share my screen. Any questions or comments so far? I think I've said too much, but. Okay, here. Okay, can everyone see my screen? I know that it's like a. Okay. Great. So the story of Esther, as we know, Esther goes to Ahasuerus. She convinces Ahasuerus to save her and their people. Haman ends up being killed. She goes to Ahasuerus later on, asks him to repel, or sorry, to repeal the original decree. Ahasuerus is like, cannot repeal the original decree, but he can write a different decree instead. And this is the decree that we're told as follows. So this is what they wrote. Vayichtov b'shem ha'melech Ahasuerus, vayichtom et taba'at ha'melech, vayishlach tzvarim b'yad ha'ratzim basusim, rochavei ha'arechesh ha'chashternim b'ner ha'machim. They wrote the following message in name of Ahasuerus, and they sent it with the quickest of all messengers. Asher natan ha'melech la'yehudim asher b'chol ir va'ir, that the king gave permission to the Jews in every city, lehikahel, to gather, v'la'amod al nafsham, and to stand, defend their lives, lehashmid, to destroy, laharog, to kill, la'abed, to lose or to annihilate et kol chel am umdina hatzarim otam, all foreign enemies or forces which are troubling them, taf v'nashim, children and women, ushlalam lavoz, and to plunder their goods. This can all be done on one day, specifically it will be on the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar. This was sent out to everyone. Liyot ha-Yehudim, ha-Yehudim, atudim, layom hazeh, lihinakim oybehem, that the Jews should be prepared to avenge themselves on that day from their enemies. That's the description of the letter that is sent out publicly. Megillah continues, I'm skipping a little bit, and then in chapter 9, the story continues as follows. U'vishneimasar chodesh u'chodesh Adar, the letter was sent out in Nisan, so this is almost 11, 12 months later. We're told as follows, the letter comes about, and here's what happened, asher yishletu ha-Yehudim hema b'sonehem, that the day came for the Jews to conquer or to rule over their enemies. We're told that on that given day, the Jews gathered together to attack, to hurt, or to defend themselves against those who want to hurt them. And no one was able to stand in their way. Everyone is afraid of Mordechai. I'm skipping a little bit. Verse 5. The Jews indeed smote their enemies, a makat cherev, some type of thing with sword, and killing, and destruction, and they did it with their enemies as they pleased. Shushan Abira, specifically, we're told that in Shushan, they killed Abed, and they also destroyed Chamesh Meot Ish, 500 people, as well as Pashadat Abed, the whole list of 10 different names, Vaser Pnei Haman, Serer HaYehudim Haragu, Uvabiza Lo Shalchu Et Yadam. However, they did not take any of the plunder. Bayomahu Bamispar Hogim Shushan Abira Lifnei Melech, on that day, the number of people came in front of the king. The king heard how many people there was, and he told the following thing. He called up Esther. Esther gets called up in front of him. He says, what do you want to do at this point? Verse 13, Vatomer Esther imal ha-melech tov, inatein gam machar la-yehudim asher b'shushan, la'asot kedat hayom, v'et aseret b'nei Haman itlu ha-la'etz. Esther asks, please, if the king be kind, allow the Jews in Shushan to reenact today and to defend themselves as they did before, meaning tomorrow on the 14th, as well as publicly hang Haman's 10 sons on a tree. The king indeed allows that. We're told that the Jews of Shushan do it, and they kill on that day, in addition to the 500 they originally killed, they were told, verse 15, they kill another 300 people. However, uva bizalo shalchu et yadam, they did not take any of the plunder, did not take any of the booty. In verse 17, we have a summary then of 16, sorry, we have a summary then of what happened amongst all of the surrounding countries. And we're told, Ushar ha-Yehudim asher b'mdinot ha-melech, nikalu b'amod al-nafsham, v'noach m'oyvehem, v'rog b'stonehem, chamisha b'shibim elef, uva bizalo shalchu et yadam. The rest of the Jews, everywhere else, they killed on the 13th of Adar, 75,000 people, but they did not touch the plunder. So that's what we have in terms of our story of the Megillah, of what characterizes, what we're celebrating. Somebody have a question or stop the share? Okay. So in terms of the questions or the critiques that people bring, I'm going to kind of list them out because I think it's worth listing them out before we kind of respond to them. But to kind of list them out, part of the critique is that the number of dead seems to be unreasonably high. 75,000 people is an incredibly large number. It certainly seems that way. So that's kind of critique number one. There's a very, very large amount of people being killed. Number two, shockingly, when Mordechai sends out the original decree, he says that this decree is not only to defend yourself, but who specifically can you defend yourself against? All who want to harm yourself, as well as taf v'nashim, the woman and the children. And the inclusion of women and children feels, for many, I think, in modern times, to feel rather almost vindictive, or doesn't really care about human life. Presumably, the children especially are not guilty of anything. I'm doubtful the women are, but certainly the children were not guilty of, harming the Jews. They certainly were no threat to the Jews. So why are they included within this large permission of who can be killed? And I'd say more than that. The more you read the story and you actually look at the words, the more you get the feeling that there's in almost this intentional language of this intense, like, killing. Like, it's not just that, oh, we're killing our enemies. It sounds like there's something almost, this like destruction. There's this entire annihilation of them. So, for instance, let me go back to open up the doc again. So if you take a look, for instance, at verse 5 here, we're told, verse 5 in chapter 9, the Jews killed all of their enemies. So enemies certainly is limiting. But we're told, makat cherev v'hereg v'ovdan, a smiting with a sword, with killing, with destruction. I mean, I don't know. This English is the particular Sepharius translation, but how exactly you translate this could be a little bit debated. But there's a lot of words here to describe this intense, utter destruction. This is not just killing. This is destroying, doing with them as you please. There is this intense sense of vayasuvisonim, almost. The Jews are taking control. They're almost having this revenge killing. It feels rather almost disturbing in the sense of the intensity of this killing. And it's not just that. I think in addition to that, there's the sense that it's one thing to understand the Jews need to defend themselves on the 13th of Adar. Why? Because on the 14th of Adar, because on the 13th of Adar, the king had sent a decree the year previous saying that all the enemies of the Jews could do with the Jews whatever they wished. They could kill the Jews. So the Jews had to unite and defend themselves. Okay, that makes sense. I understand now why they have to defend themselves on the 13th. But then Esther comes on the 13th, or at the end of the day, and she speaks to Ahasuerus, and she asks Ahasuerus for one more day. One more day to kill the enemies, which are in the capital city of Shushan. Now, that would seem to be a little bit excessive. The Jews, the other people of Shushan, were not threatening the Jews on the 14th. If anything, we had the feeling that they were so afraid of everyone because of how powerful the Jews were. So it's very hard to understand, the justification almost of why you're allowed to kill people on the 14th. What's the point of that? And then to, almost public to hang the children of Haman. I mean, what did the children of Haman do? We have no mention of the Megillah of them doing anything wrong. It seems almost gratuitous, this public hanging. And then finally, I think this especially had a lot of resonance with, the last several months, but there is a larger theme in the Megillah that connects the story of Haman specifically with the story of Amalek. The story of this hated enemies of Jews, that there are several different stories in Tanakh that discuss it, but effectively they are meant to be effaced off the face of the earth. They are meant to be destroyed completely, annihilated. And there are a lot of parallels, and it's intentional. It's certainly not meant to be, I think we all kind of can tell. Haman is called Agagi, relating to it. The language here of destruction sounds like the language of Amalek. The language of remembering what happens today sounds like the language of remembering what happens with Amalek. There's so much similarities that it feels like we're talking another Amalek story. And so, if Amalek is itself a question that feels potentially for some people theologically troubling, how can we kill this nation that, their ancestors might have done something, but they themselves haven't done anything? By bringing that within the Megillah, you're kind of just adding, flame to the fire in terms of this is just one more story of Jews going out of their way to be vengeful and bloodthirsty. That's, I think, the critique of the Megillah. I think even if you are sympathetic to the Megillah, even if you love the Megillah, you love Esther, I think for many of us, it's a story that the very end of the book still feels a little, we kind of rush through it because we feel a little bit uncomfortable about it. We don't try thinking too much about it. And I think it's really a question that certainly this year has a lot of, a lot of relevance. So I think so. That's kind of the question. That's the way I want to begin this problem, this question. Any comments, questions so far about the issues I've addressed, or raised? Wait, sorry, I can't really hear you through. I don't know if everyone else can, but I'm having trouble hearing you.
I think she doesn't know she's not on mute.
Okay, not a problem then. Okay, well, let's continue. Okay.
I texted her to let her know that she was not muted, but I didn't get a response.
Okay, not a
And
problem.
I actually, I'll just say something. I mean, this is given the moment we're in, I guess to use a term that we've heard lately, we don't have the full context of what was going on in Shushan and in the Outer Kingdoms, what rallies were going on, what posters were being hung up, and how threatened the Jews really felt. So I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting which side context is important to. But it's, yes, absolutely. You're right. We don't have the Megillah is sparse. Megillah tells a very small part of the story. It does not tell the rest of the story. The Megillah is centered around Shushan. We, in fact, don't have any indication of what happened in the other 126 provinces. And even within Shushan, we're hearing a very narrow perspective. We hear of what happens in some point, beginning of Nisan or Sivan, when they send out the letters, we hear nothing again for another 10 months. For all you know, the Jews had been, there had been a pogrom for all you know in the meantime. It's hard to really know. We have some verses, we don't really know too much. 100%, there's not much context. So, in terms of dealing with it, what I want to suggest, or the way I want to approach this, is I want to first suggest. There are two main approaches. There's one approach which suggests that anything that did happen was either justified or was not nearly as bad as has been depicted. For whatever reason, we can justify the Jews' action. It was completely justified. It was very much in the right. There's nothing they did wrong. There's a second approach that I want to then talk about afterwards, which is maybe the Jews, what they did by was problematic, and how do we then deal with that? So at least within the first approach, the kind of the catch-all for many different types of responses, but this is a very common response, especially amongst Israeli scholars, is modern scholars and former and especially Israeli modern scholars, is to kind of push back on many of these issues. So, for instance, on the claim that the Jews were responsible for not only killing their enemies, but also killing the children, there are responses that say, well, some people suggest maybe the children didn't happen. Maybe, for instance, the way that some academics argue, maybe the text itself doesn't say that. Maybe it was like a later addition from this is the way like one scholar writes, it was a later addition from like a later author who included it, who didn't understand what was happening in the story and, hated the Jews or wanted to insert something that wasn't really properly there. Others, you don't have to take that such an extensive reading, but I think, but there one a different response is to say that, yeah, maybe Mordechai's letter, when he sent out the letter, said that you could kill the children and kill the woman, but it doesn't say they actually did that. It says they killed their enemies. There's no mention of them actually killing their children and killing the woman. In fact, some argue that the Megillah points out over and over again, this is indisputable, that what the Jews did not do, though they had the right to do so, was they did not pillage. They did not take from any of the loot, any of the booty. They did not take from any of the spoils of war. And Megillah repeats it three times to really emphasize how much, though the fact that the Jews were allowed to do so, they didn't do so. And so some want to suggest that just as the Jews were allowed to collect from the booty and they didn't, so too, though Mordechai allowed them to kill to kill women and children, they didn't do it. They didn't kill women and children. They had that moral compass, so to speak. The problem with that argument is, well, the Megillah doesn't really say that. So it's hard to really know. There's no mention of the children, but there's no mention of children not being killed. The Megillah is kind of, ambiguous as to that particular question. Why would, if we were according to this approach, why would Megillah, or why, better yet, why would Mordechai tell the Jews that they're allowed to kill the women and children? Like, doesn't that raise these ethical flags? Why would he even do so if it was no intention of doing it? So perhaps the best answer, and I think there's a lot of truth to this, is that the Megillah almost intentionally is trying to parallel between what happened in the beginning of the story, what's happening at the end. One of the major themes of Megillat Esther is a theme of nahpochu, of reversals, that we started one way, we end a different way, almost exactly the opposite. And in the beginning of the story, in chapter 3, Haman sends out this letter that all the Jews can be killed, including the women and the children, all on one day. And Mordechai's response then in his letter is to counter that point by point. Almost every single point, every single thing that happened is being reversed. And so the response, in terms of his ethical quandary, is that it's not that Mordechai necessarily is advocating for the murder of children and women, but rather that Mordechai is simply echoing Haman's original decree, and the Megillah is intentionally writing it in this way in order to really accentuate the change and the extensive turnaround that had happened from the beginning of the Megillah to what has happened now. That's, one large way of approaching that particular problem. Likewise, in terms of the problem of the number of dead, there are many that have been pointed out that yes, 75,000 feels like it's a lot, but within biblical numbers, it's not clear it is a lot. There are stories in the Bible where many more than that died. There's a story in Divrei Hayamim where Ahijah kills 500,000 people on one day. And maybe those numbers seem almost fanciful, but at least within the world of the Bible, 75,000 is not as, as unfathomable as it is maybe to our modern ears. Some also point out that if you count the number of provinces, if you think about the fact that Ahasuerus was not the king of just Shushan, but rather was the king of all 127 provinces, if you divide 75,000 by 127, you have a much more number, in the several hundreds, which perhaps is a little bit more reasonable. At least this is the response. Their response, likewise, in terms of this killing, is to emphasize or to counter that this is not this vengeful, gratuitous, bloodthirsty killing. In fact, we don't have the context here, but maybe all these people really did hate the Jews. And in fact, if you take a look at the verses, there certainly seems to be that the verses have this emphasis on the fact that the people who they are attacking are those who in themselves were threats or those who were enemies. So for instance, let me share my screen again. If you look back at those verses, no. If you look back at these verses, you'll see specifically, Mordechai sends a letter and tells them to kill specifically Hatzarimotam, those who are being troublesome to you, and specifically Hinakei me'oiveihem, specifically to avenge on your enemies. And there's this emphasis of enemies and enemies consistently over and over again, focusing on the fact that these aren't just random people; these aren't the innocent Gentiles of the land who are peaceful people who are being killed. These are rather those who are hateful, those who themselves maybe have taken up arms against the Jews. That's the response from the language, from the emphasis. And then in terms of the other problems, the problem of why then did Esther ask for another day of killing? The response is, well, maybe Shushan really was this center of hate. Maybe Shushan really was, it's the capital city. It was Haman's, main planning stage. Maybe it's somewhere where there really were all these enemies around, and they needed an extra day to really root out all of these problems. And the fact that they had another 300 to kill really shows, the extent of the problem. And finally, when it comes to the problem of Haman's children being hanged, why specifically are they being hanged? The response is, well, we don't know specific things in Megillah of Haman's children participating, but we don't get the feeling that Haman's children are innocent. They certainly are participating, as with Zeresh, in terms of Haman's planning at some point. We have a talk about him gathering up his children. You certainly can imagine that Haman's children played a role and were active. And specifically in terms of public hanging, it's worth noting that we already have two other examples of hanging within the Megillah. We have it with regard to Haman, or originally it was going to be Mordechai, and we have it earlier in the Megillah with regard to Bigthan and Teresh. And the way that many understand hanging is that hanging is not just a form of death, it's specifically a type of punishment that is done for those who have committed treason. Those who have committed a crime against the king, against the crown, they are publicly hanged to make a statement that treason is going to be punished at the strictest of terms. And perhaps what Esther is asking by hanging the sons of Haman is to emphasize the fact that when you hurt Jews, it's not just you're doing some type of crime, but it's a treasonous crime. It's a crime against the crown. And so to really emphasize that, we hang publicly the 10 sons of Haman to really make it clear to all the people who hate Jews that this is not something going to be tolerated within Ahasuerus's lands. That's kind of the response that many make in terms of defending this type of response. So, for instance, in terms of like specifics, I'll just quote to you. Fox, who's one of the major modern scholars on Esther, writes that vengeance is not gratuitous. It's a legitimate exercise of punitive power outside of a judicial context. This is kind of the only thing Jews could do. Goethen, who's this German scholar, points out that in terms of the numbers themselves aren't so bad. This wasn't necessarily a war of aggression. It's not that bad. That's kind of the response that many make to the story, that to paint it as a story of untoward aggression is not only not being fair or judicial to or judicious, but in fact it is being callous about Jewish lives without understanding the context, without understanding the risk that the Jews really faced and the need for themselves to defend themselves. That's, broadly speaking, and we can talk about like the small differences here and there, but broadly speaking, that's one approach to defending the Megillah. And I think in terms of the modern equivalent, I think it's fairly clear that one of the responses, so to speak, to the claim that Israel has been engaged in genocide is to respond that it's not genocide. It's specifically targeting those who are conspirators, those who are enemies, those who want to harm us. And as well, it's specifically a response to what they did originally to us, and there is kind of a limit to it. It's not just this vindictive punishment. It's something really needed from self-defense. I think broadly speaking, you can kind of see those parallels play out. I see there's a comment in the chat. Yeah, okay. So when he talks about children, yeah, I don't want to start debating. There's a comment in the chat about the fact that the children, specifically for Palestinians, have been brought up with this hateful knowledge of Jews or hateful belief of Jews. Yeah, I don't want to talk too much about killing of children. I think we can, all be of agreement that when it comes to children, I don't mean specifically Palestinian children. I'll say children of, let's say, of Haman's, generation. I think we can all agree that 4-year-olds are not necessarily, are not the same as 15-year-olds, 17-year-olds. I'm not only talking about the 17-year-olds. So, we can talk about the differences here, certainly, but I think broadly speaking, at least one, what I'm trying to suggest is there's kind of this one approach of the necessity of the Jewish response for their own self-defense. That's kind of one large response to this problem. Any other comments or questions? Okay, great. The second type of response is to play down, sorry, not to play down, not is to admit that there's something about the Megillah that indeed feels problematic. It does sound like there's something problematic. So there's kind of, how do you respond if it is problematic? You know, you could reject the Megillah out of hand, but what else do you do with the Megillah if it's not, you know, this, if there is something rather problematic in what's happening here? So one way that people have pointed out is that there's something almost, the way the Megillah tells a story, it, yes, it's true that there's something almost, it sounds, you know, excessive. Yeah, somebody have a question? No. There's something almost maybe excessive sounding within the way the punishment is done, but maybe that's almost intentional. The way the Megillah is written is you have this sense that many of the details written are written almost in this fanciful language. Megillah very begins with this crazy party of 180 days. And you have this king of 127 provinces. And he brings out every single type of gold and every single part of thing. And you have this sense of not just the lavishness and the, you know, but and not just the excessiveness, but you have a sense of there's almost this exaggeration taking place here. And the number 75,000, it seems almost fanciful. 75,000 people being killed in one day. The Jews, there are a lot of Jews, but not that many Jews. There are so many Jews that are able to kill 75,000 people in one day. And beyond that, if you take a look at the numbers, when does Achashverosh learn about the numbers of Jews that were of people that were killed? He learns about it the very next day. That sounds impossible. I don't think we could come up with a number even today, even with modern technology, the day after something took place, let alone in, you know, ancient Persia, where, you know, they would send out news by horses. Like it, I think it's by, you know, by messengers. I think it's rather astounding that they know how many people were killed. Even within Shushan itself, it sounds rather surprising how they know how many people were killed. And so one way that many want to read the story of the Megillah, and I think there actually is a lot of truth to this, is that the Megillah has this almost fanciful aspect to it. The way that academics might talk about it is they talk about it as this genre of what's called a carnivalesque, this carnival-like scene. You can imagine almost these peasants. This is kind of where it originates from. And when peasants wouldn't have something, you know, better to think about, so they would have these carnivals. And during the carnival, they would have some sort of play reenacting that was made make-believe, where the whole point of the play was it was almost a topsy-turvy world where either there was no hierarchy or the hierarchy was flipped on its head, where the peasants were in charge instead of the kings, and the peasants could do whatever they want. And one of the things that characterized these type of plays was that there was this almost craziness to it, that when the gory, you know, death appeared, it appeared in almost this crazy way that sounds almost clean. The 75,000 people who die, there's no mention here of the gore, of the blood, of the pain. This is not the way that I would think of 75,000 people dying. This is not descriptive. This is not something that evokes this intense pain. It sounds almost not whitewashing is not the right word. It sounds like you're intentionally exaggerating to make the story sound fanciful, sound like it's a kid's story, where you're playing it up as a cartoon. It's buffoonish almost. And if that's true, then maybe the whole Megillah is meant to be looked at almost as this in this buffoonish way. The numbers are exaggerated, that what happens is exaggerated, and everything here is written in a way that's really meant to overly emphasize this, you know, buffoonery. I'll quote to you one particular way this is written. This is the way that Adele Berlin describes it. She says as follows. A better way, source number five, a better way to relate to the events of chapter 9 is to see them as part of the carnivalesque farce that permeates the whole book and defines its genre. Scenes of tumultuous riots and violent mock destruction are completely at home in farcical and carnivalesque works. In fact, they are the hallmarks. Chapter 9 is the climax of the carnivalesque, the peak of disorder. Exaggeration and irrationality reach new heights, even for this book. The slaughter portrayed at the narrative's conclusion provides catharsis for readers and celebrants. The narrative concludes with a great killing spree, which is meant to release the tension of the reader and those who now celebrate. So there's a sense that perhaps what's happening here is intentionally written in a way that's meant to feel absurd. Whether or not that absurdity means it did happen or didn't happen is it's a question on its own. I don't want to talk too much about the historical reality of it. You can certainly argue whether or not it did happen, whether it didn't happen. But the point being here is that it's written in a way that's almost meant to emphasize this craziness. I want to suggest a different way of looking at it, admitting there is something wrong with happening in Megillah. And I think this is a way that we also have to contend with that had its own importance for the way the Megillah is read. So a third way to look at it is that maybe, yes, in truth, there was. Maybe the Megillah indeed is evoking something wrong or writing about something that was wrong, that sounds, from at least from our modern sensibilities, that feels unethical. And maybe that's okay. Maybe the point of the Megillah is not that it's supposed to be perfect. Why do we assume that that everything that happens in Megillah is perfect? This is exactly what should happen. In terms of a celebration, I'll argue, and I'll say this again a little bit later, we're not celebrating the killing. We're celebrating the holiday later. That's why we don't celebrate on the 13th. We celebrate on the 14th and the 15th in walled cities. We don't celebrate on the days of the actual murder. So we're not celebrating the murder, and maybe the murder, maybe the killings were problematic. Maybe the world that is described is problematic. If so, then the question obviously is raised is why? Why would it be problematic? What's the point of all this? And this brings us to some of the major, major themes of the Megillat Esther that plays into this idea. And there are two themes I want to play with and point out. Theme number one, and we've talked about this a little bit, but I want to reemphasize it, is one of the major themes of the Megillah is this idea of Nahapochu, that the world is flipped on its head. What we thought was going to happen actually ends up happening exactly the reverse. Originally, Haman's on the rise, then it's going to be Mordechai on the rise. Every single thing that starts off in the beginning ends up being reversed by the end. It's one of the major, major themes of the Megillah. And certainly having this almost exaggerated murder spree of all of these non-Jews plays into the idea of this incredible exaggeration of the Jews not only are being the ones who are going to be killed, but they are actually the ones who are going to kill all the non-Jews. You have this incredible backwards world. Why? Why do we have this backwards Nahapochu? There are a few different reasons you can provide. One of the simplest ones, I believe, is that we're supposed to get a sense that the Megillah's world is not perfect. It's not meant to be a world where things go right. In fact, as been many pointed out, there is something shocking about Megillat Esther that doesn't appear in any other book of Tanakh. Namely, that we have the word Hamelech, the king, appears over and over and over again, but we never have a specific king reference. We never have the divine king. God does not play a role in the whole story. Now, one response is, oh, God doesn't play a role because God's in the background. Yes, true. But I think part of the story here is to also tell us that God is not present, that what's happening here are the faults of human beings who are taking control and doing crazy things. And that's part of this upside down world. Part of the story of Megillat Esther is we are in Galut, we are in exile, and part of Galut is backwards. This is the craziness of what Galut looks like, where we don't have this, you know, moral clarity that exists within the Galut, within its exile. It doesn't happen. Something very related to this that I think a second theme, which is very much related, it's a little bit different, but for our purposes, I think you can kind of imagine almost as one. One of the second major theme of the Megillat Esther is the idea of the word of law. The most common word in Megillat Esther, besides proper nouns, names and the like, is the word dat. Dalid Taf, meaning law, rule of law. Why is it so common? Because Megillat Esther begins and ends with the rule of law. It's a book about the king and the king's laws. But from the very beginning, it should be clear that the laws here are being made fun of. There's an arbitrariness, a almost ridiculousness to the way the laws appear. For instance, think about the very first chapter. Ahasuerus has this problem. His wife, Vashti, refuses to come. So he calls up all his top advisors, which needs to be dealt with some, internal, for his internal domestic issues. He has to call all of his advisors. And his advisor's response is not only to kill Vashti or get rid of her, but is also to send out a letter to every single household in throughout the land to emphasize the fact that the man is in charge of the households. Now, that is ridiculous. You don't have to be a feminist to understand that there's something insane. The fact that you need to repeat that to everyone shows you that the men are not in charge of their household. The whole idea of law here is either superfluous, it's not needed, or it's being made fun of. These letters don't mean anything. Everyone's looking at these. What are they going to look at? Ahasuerus sends out a letter that says to everyone that, you have to, that the man is in charge of, of the household. It doesn't seem like that's needed in this type of society. There's something ridiculous about it. And it keeps happening over and over again. Ahasuerus is someone who, as a king, who is in charge of everything, is incredibly whimsical and, and capricious. He's someone who at one moment will be very generous, who gives, his whole kingdom or half his, who gives everyone in his kingdom part of his party, who is willing, when he's impressed with his wife, he's willing to give her half of his kingdom. And on the other hand, he gets angry and kills his wife, kills his top advisor. He creates these decrees that are absurd, that don't have any real logic to them. It doesn't care about the consequences. You have this sense that it's this world that, though they claim that law controls everything, as a matter of fact, law is not here. There is no law. There's this sense of lawlessness and randomness that takes place throughout the Megillah. And perhaps it's precisely for that reason that the Megillah writes that the Jews, indeed, as part of their, so to speak, reaction to what Haman did, was they killed all of these 75,000 people. Because think of the irony here. The irony is that the Jews were described by Haman at first. Why were should they be killed? Because this Yesh Am Echad, Mefuzar Umfarad Bein Amim, there are these people who are spread about between the nations. Vedatehem shonot mikol am. And what is so problematic about them? They don't follow our laws. They don't follow our customs. They're weird. They're different. And therefore, we should get rid of them. What's ironic then is that the critique is that what the Jews end up doing is they end up following the letter of the law. The law tells them you can kill almost indiscriminately all of these people. They do that. That's the law they follow. They don't deserve to be killed for not following the law. In fact, the problem with the story here, the problem with the story as a whole, is that the law doesn't make sense. That the law here is problematic. Maybe there's some type of, vindictive killing here that's happening, but this is a type of law that extends everywhere. Think about even what happens to Haman. Haman is a person who certainly is an evil individual, the worst of the worst, deserves to be put away. For sure, be killed. Why does Haman get killed? Why, in fact, in the moment of his death, does Haman actually be killed? Because during the party, when Esther pleads for her people's life, her husband Ahasuerus is so angry, he goes outside for a few moments. Haman, in the meantime, realizes that he needs to plead for his life, so he leans on Esther in some way, pleading for his life. And just as the king comes back, Haman falls. He trips. Something happens. And Ahasuerus assumes, maybe, it certainly looks suggestive, but Ahasuerus assumes that Haman is, in this moment, attacking Esther. When we know as readers, that's not at all what was happening. And so for Haman's audacity for attacking Esther in this particular scene, Haman is killed. But think about that. Haman is killed, but not even for the right reason. Helen is killed for something he's actually not guilty of. He's not guilty of trying to, do something to Esther and his particular party. He does want to, mass murder of Jews, but that's not why he's being killed. The Megillah as a whole, if the more you look at it, the more you realize it is messed up. It's a messed up world that's supposed to really point out God is not here. The Persians are in charge. They think that law is in charge, that they follow the law when really the law itself becomes it's is actually immoral. The laws themselves that they claim to follow don't make sense. And this is a story that needs fixing, that needs to be fixed better. So in that way, let me quote to you one particular reading of that. I can show you that. Take a look, for instance, at the way that Erica Brown, in her book, she has a book on Esther's published not too long ago. And she writes as follows amongst a larger part. She says as follows, the Jews of Persia, 4:6, were prepared to be invisible, utterly unnoticeable, but exile did not allow for this luxury. One could be hated or one could hate. One could be too powerless or too powerful. One could be killed or kill. These are choiceless choices. No saner, no moderate, more subtle choices were available in exile. One must, at base, survive. In the way that she paints it, Megillat Esther is a story of where is no perfect solution. There are no real morals because you do have this dichotomy, you have this binary. Either you kill or you are be killed. There is no middle ground. Talking about moral choices here doesn't have the ring of truth because it doesn't really exist. And more broadly, if you take a look, for instance, Fox, who is someone who defends the Jews broadly or has a more favorable reading, points out in source 7, it is doubtful that the conduct of war, even on the part of the defender, is, if power balance allows for it, ever free of vengeance, brutality, and overkill. The battles of Adar certainly were not. That's his statement. This is a book published in the late 90s, just to be clear in terms of time-wise. And I think this perspective is a very opposite perspective than the first one. This suggests that what happened in the Megillah was not correct. If we were to do it again, if I were to suggest or prescribe the correct moral action, I would not suggest that we should kill 75,000 people, that we should try to indiscriminately kill also women and children. Perhaps they're all wrong, but the Megillah is not necessarily saying that that's justified. No one's pretending that that is the correct thing to do. In fact, Megillah's point is, it is wrong. The world itself is problematic. The world itself, maybe the Jews had no better choice. Maybe the world gives you these horrible binaries, but that's the world that the Jews live in Megillat Esther. To then translate that, and this is going to be a little bit touchy, so I want to be very careful in terms of how I phrase this. But to then translate that same idea into more modern terms, one way, certainly, I'm not here to give my own judgment of what's happening in Israel. I don't think that's my, I'm not qualified for it, and everyone is entitled to their own opinions. I'm happy to talk to you privately about my opinions, but that's not what I'm trying to do here. One way that you can look legitimately at the story of what's happening in Israel is to look at it as a legitimate response of self-defense. That's kind of the response that we first talked about. The other response is to say maybe it's not self-defense. Maybe it's not fully legitimate. Maybe there are problems. Maybe there are things that are going too far. Sure, we can talk about all of those different responses. At the end of the day, what Megillat Esther is responding to is this idea that the world as a whole is not perfect. The world as a whole needs more fixing. Things need to be done. Now, whether that things need to be done mean that we shouldn't fight this particular war, or whether it just means that there's no real sense of morality, that morality, as much as we try and believe that this thing is moral or that thing is moral, we never really can hit the mark because the world doesn't allow us it to. The idea that what's happening in these wars, there's going to be so much fog, there's so much uncertainty, it's not clear what the right thing to do is. And maybe that's war always. That's the war that always begins. That's the way Fox kind of describes it, that war always has these moral problems. To anyone to ever claim that war was fought justly, at least according to this perspective, doesn't make any, it's not, is blind to themselves. It doesn't really make sense. There's no real morality. So, this is a different perspective. It's not the same perspective. I think you certainly can associate yourself better with the first perspective, the perspective of it's a just fight. But what I certainly want to point out is that this is a question within the Megillah. The Megillah raises this question: how do we respond to it? And we can, in our own turn, respond to it in different ways. And that same type of question is one that we deal with nowadays with the same similar type of responses in terms of: do we concede that there is justified? Do we concede that maybe there's something wrong with it, something morally problematic? Where exactly do we draw the line? What do we do practically? These are very, very difficult questions. And the Megillah is not giving us easy answers, does not spell it out for us because they're so difficult. I know I've said a lot, and I know I've said a lot that's rather heavy and controversial about, especially what's happened nowadays. I'm happy to speak more about this. Any questions or comments so far? I don't want to get I don't want to get too far afield. Okay, I want to do one thing because I think it's really important. I think this actually does bring a lot of context to this story because that was a word that was brought up early that is needed to be brought into this thing. And this is something I actually personally was aware of this to some extent, but I've recently learned more and more about how true it is. There's something fascinating about Megillat Esther in terms of its history of scholarship. And that is that while it's a book that for Jews has been celebrated for a long time, it's a great story, it's a story for feminists, Esther is great, amazing. For people who aren't Jews, especially Protestants, it's been a story that has been critiqued a lot. And some of these critiques, especially, are not just critical of the book itself for reasons that we've described, that maybe, it seems like we're this violence, but it very quickly turns into this anti-Semitic response. Take a look, for instance, here, and I have a few sources just quoting it. Martin Luther, the famous Martin Luther, who, kind of began the entire Protestant movement, said, "I am so an enemy of the Book of Esther that I would it not exist, for it Judaizes too much and hath in it a great deal of heathenish naughtiness." I think you can agree about the fact that, maybe it's not a great book in terms of the violence, but calling it Judaizing it too much, that's anti-Semitic. That's associating it with Jews. And this isn't just him. This is something that consistently comes up amongst scholars, especially, and this is perhaps not so ironic, especially amongst biblical German scholars in the at the beginning of the 20th century, which is a famous, time when they weren't particularly friends of Jews. So if you take a look at source number 9 and 10, you'll see response, Esther and Mordecai, this is a translation, of course. Esther and Mordecai clearly expressed the perverted character traits of crooked late Judaism. Or we have a mention about much more numerous are the revolting negative traits of this nation's character. It's an unrestrained impulse to avenge. It literally imagines swimming and drowning with Oriental abandon in the blood of its enemy. The language here is not just critical of the Book of Esther, but placing it within, the larger context, and it's anti-Semitic. And it's not just only against Jews, it actually also has a resonance with Zionists. If you take a look at source number 11, this is perhaps more shocking because Introduction to the Old Testament, this is one of the, it's part of a larger series of books of scholarly books on the Bible. And it's a pretty well-respected one. This was written in 1952, so this is after the Holocaust. And if you take a look, Robert Pfeiffer, the author, says as follows. He has a whole critique of the book, and he says at one point, I'm skipping a little bit, this religious indifference, touch of sarcasm for Jewish sacred institutions is in sharp contrast with the author's passionate, sanguinary patriotism, his chauvinistic loyalty to his race, as in the case of some modern Zionists, has no relation to religion. Now that is a completely unnecessary blow by. There's no reason to mention Zionism in this book. No reason to mention it at all, but it creeps in over and over again. Not just Zionism, but Judaism. This anti-Semitic discussion of the book, and I think certainly in our modern context, when we talk about Israel, you cannot divorce the way you feel about the war from the way that everyone else in the world responds to it. Specifically, Israel amongst all other nations. That's certainly something that comes up here in this story in Megillat Esther and comes up as well within our modern context. I will end with the following, which is perhaps a little bit more hopeful, although I guess we can see whether it's changing. It is worth noting that at least within the history of scholarship, that Robert Pfeiffer, the source we just saw, notwithstanding, there was a very perceptible shift in the way that scholars viewed Megillat Esther before the Holocaust and after the Holocaust. So if you take a look at the way that some people will quote after the Holocaust, you'll get a very different perspective. And it's a perspective of no. Yes, there might be what seems like brutality, seems like overly excessive violence, but all that is necessary. Fox, for instance, source 13 says, Esther's requests, Mordechai's decree, the people's conduct of the war have been condemned for displaying aggressiveness, brutality, vindictiveness. Such opprobrium is unwarranted, for the Jews' fight was necessary, defensive, and justified. And perhaps even strongly, the next source 14, perhaps the events in Esther never happened. Many would refer it that way, avoiding chapter 9. But among those who know the horrors of the Crusades, or the terror of the Holocaust, or might I add, the events of October 7th, who would deny that such acts happen? But they should not. Meaning, these things do happen. The Jews are persecuted, and this is how we defend ourselves. And I'll finish with this 15. Apart from the evidence of scroll itself, we lack any information about the type of genocide described in the story. Unfortunately, that has not been the case throughout Jewish history. The rampant destruction of European Jewish communities in the recent past is similar to a threat described but not fulfilled in Esther. Haman's spiritual descendants proved more successful in attaining their goal of genocide. And so, while talking about the very powerful and necessary parallels between Megillat Esther and our modern time, one third parallel, in addition to the question of the war and how we respond to it, as well as the question of the morality, is a question of how does everyone else in the world see us and see this particular book? It is a book where people can have opinions without bringing in their other more pernicious, anti-Semitic, xenophobic positions on Jews broadly? Or does that color in a very strong way everything they see and do? And to talk about Israel and not talk about anti-Semitism, you're missing part of the story here. So what I'm trying to be clear in terms of this whole presentation is both Megillat Esther and certainly what's happening today in 2024 cannot be oversimplified. I certainly have no answers. The Megillah presents very difficult questions. There are different ways of dealing with these questions, but these are all part of the larger context. Knowing on the one hand that there is room to talk about the need for defense, just as there is room to talk about maybe this is an overreaction, maybe this proved that morality, we're not living in a golden age of morality, there's still what to go for, and the larger context of how does the world look at Jews broadly? This is not a question that only applies to Israel, but applies to many different things happening worldwide, and yet Israel, the Jews, are often targeted specifically. Whether that justifies the actions of the Jews, that's its own question, but I think Megillat Esther raises these questions in a very serious way and makes us really think about how we want to relate to these questions and to the world at large. So, thank you for joining me. I know this was a very heavy topic, controversial topic. I'm happy to take any more questions. I want to just end by saying two things. Number one is that next week, a little bit less controversial, but still really important, I want to talk about Ahasuerus and the complicity or apathy of those who allow violence to take place, which certainly relates to what's happening nowadays, happens with the UN Women's Ethics Committee that has ignored entirely the what happened on October 7th. Certainly, I want to talk about that. So that's what's going to happen next week, same time October on same time on Thursday. And I want to also thank the sponsors of today's class, including Anne Gold, Hirsch and Barry Love, Judith Hollander, Paul and Dee Dee Applebaum, Robin Jessica Sachs, Rachel and Yonadav Shavit, and the Schramm family. Thank you all for joining. I'll stay on for as long as you guys want. So I'm happy to take any more questions. But thank you for joining. I hope I was able to add some clarity and nuance and not oversimplify and create too much confusion. Yeah, Anne, do you have a question?
I was just gonna, so you were talking about Haman was just leaning over to Esther, and I guess I never gave a great thought because that's the way I learned it in, third grade or whatever.